never knew your
I guess so, bro. Brooklyn, I'm going to all of you, and especially to our dear friend, Mr. Dieter. Welcome back. And both of us to Khaled. Today's discussion will be on the subject of informed consent. And what are the limits? I will begin and present, in short, a few cases which we have already distributed in the invitation. And then I'll ask Dr. Avenheim to present the medical and legal contemporary approach to these shyness. So the first I mentioned four cases, and I'll go over them briefly. The question is this basic right of informed consent, what are the limits and the dilemmas which they can cause? And it's a famous case in the media. The Vancouver parents of sextuplets born in January are in a legal battle with the province, claiming that the government violated their religious rights when social workers seized three of their newborns to give them blood transfusions. That means that the parents, for religious reasons, did not agree to the medical treatment, and the government forced it on them. What is the DAP toilet? The second question was, a pregnant woman who was told that her children had Down syndrome, mongoloid, and severe heart problems, and the doctors recommended a cesarean to reduce the stress on the baby. She refuses, probably because she's not interested that the child should survive. The question is, well, here we have a conflict between the interest of the mother and the interest of the child. Can she be forced to undergo this procedure? The third question was, parents who do not agree to have their children vaccinated for serious diseases, also probably for religious reasons or maybe other reasons. And the question is, if here we heed their objection to their treatment, and this might also pose a danger to the public if we have children in the school system which are not vaccinated. And then the fourth and last question is, a diabetic patient who developed gangrene in his foot, the doctors fear that the foot has to be amputated to save his life, and the patient refuses, so what should be the right approach to this question? Dr. Avenheim.
I took a look at these cases, and I'll just bring up a few of the medical aspects which I thought were pertinent to this case and how the laws in Quebec at least address these cases. The first is the Vancouver parents of the sex stoplets. I think this made quite some media attention when this happened. Sex stoplets is not something that we typically see. There's a few issues with sex stoplets. One is that it's invariably going to be secondary to IVF, any artificial reproductive technologies. And I think this highlights autonomy in the patients, because when we have sextuplets today, we typically will offer the parents a selective fetal reduction, which means we'll go and we will reduce from, let's say, 6 to 3, because we know very well that 6 babies, chances of bringing them to a survival, to a gestational age which is compatible with life, is very small. If you followed up these cases, so far the 6 babies that were born, 2 of them died already. So just as an example of this, we know that they typically don't survive. And so if we see 6 or any other higher high-order multiples, 4 or 5 will offer a reduction and bring it down to triplets or maybe twins. And what this highlights, the fact that their religion came into play, as doctors, we can't impose that on the babies, knowing very well that the babies weren't going to have a good prognosis. The parents elected not to have anything done and carry on with this very high-risk pregnancy. Now that the babies are born, however, it becomes a different problem. Are the parents allowed to impose their opinions or their religious beliefs on the newborns? According to law, at least in Quebec, and it's pretty much standard in Canada and in the U.S., the parents can't impose these beliefs if they bring up a risk for the babies. You need to have a court order, however, before you can transfuse these babies. But if you can prove pretty clearly that there's a benefit to transfusing these babies and that their lives are at stake, then that will usually go. The two issues that I saw from this is, one, the parents' autonomy to go on and carry out and not have any intervention on their babies to save the other few babies, and then whether or not they have a say in their newborns. The second one was a little interesting to me because this is typically not something that we'll ever see. At least today we don't see such a case. At 11 weeks of pregnancy, we'll typically do a screening test for Down. And the culture in North America is, if you have a Down's child, parents will choose to terminate the pregnancy. The second thing is a severe heart malformation. If there's a severe heart malformation, the first thing we do, if that's what we're going to pick up at 19 weeks on an ultrasound, is we'll look to see that the baby's okay in terms of chromosomes. So if the baby doesn't have a Down syndrome, and it's just an isolated cardiac malformation, then we will have them seen by the pediatric cardiologists, cardiac surgeons, and they'll counsel the parents as to what kind of interventions are needed. Today, if there's a Down's baby with a severe heart malformation, even if it's not a Down's baby, we'll never offer a cesarean because usually we like to have a vaginal delivery for the babies. So this particular case that I've never seen, and I know the books won't really address this because people wouldn't want to have a baby like this. That's what we've seen. And also, as obstetricians, we wouldn't offer them a cesarean. But I will tell you, a similar case like this that comes around every so often is when we have a perfectly normal baby that has a bad fetal heart tracing, and we feel sometimes, or let's say for whatever reason, we need to do a cesarean, there may be some mothers that refuse to have a cesarean. Now, a lot of times it's a little simple. You just have to say your baby's not doing too well, and they'll tend to say, okay, do whatever you need to do to take out the baby. But it happens every so often that we get a mother that says, you know, I don't care. You guys do a lot of cesarean sections that are unnecessary. I don't want to have a cesarean for this baby. And that becomes a dilemma for us because at the end of the day, we can't force someone to have a cesarean section. The third case was of the vaccination of the children. I think this past century, just the introduction of these vaccination programs have brought a tremendous decline in these diseases that we pretty much don't see anymore today. And it correlates very almost linearly with the proportion of patient population that's vaccinated. More people are vaccinated, the less likely there's to be an outbreak of the disease. The question in this particular case is a person allowed to refuse vaccinating their children? Now, the public health implications is that the less people that are vaccinated, the more you can have an outbreak. The other thing is are you allowed to impose a vaccine on a baby or on anyone? And I think medically that a person has a right to refuse any intervention that we cannot impose on them. The last case was that of the diabetic patient with a gangrenous foot. It's true a lot of times that there's some interventions that we feel are life-saving, but again, with any intervention, There's nothing that we can impose on someone, assuming that they're very competent and understand the consequences of their condition and their consequence to refuse treatment. And if they're very competent and they understand whatever sequelae may develop, there's nothing I think any doctor can really do. What we really tend to do is just assess their level of understanding of the pathogenesis and what alternatives there are and what are the consequences. And at that point, it's really the patient's autonomy, and there's not much more that we offer.
Thank you, Dr. Abadan. I want to address the whole issue of patient autonomy and informed consent. Informed consent is a relatively modern concept, first used by a federal court in the U.S. in the 1957. It's probably based on the Nuremberg Code developed after World War II to regulate medical experimentation on humans. This gradually evolved into its present form, covering all types of medical treatment and gradually spreading to all aspects of modern society. Traditionally, the relationship between a doctor and a patient has been paternalistic. Give me your child, your parents, your body, and we'll fix it, and just be quiet. I remember when we started our family in Israel from 40 years ago, addressing a doctor, you almost had to say, "Your Royal Highness." It was unbelievable. This was specially pronounced in Europe and in Israel. And this hand-off approach has engendered a high level of distrust towards the medical profession. So much so that there's a whole body of literature in Halakha about Ne'emanus Horofim. Can we trust the doctor? Baruch Hashem, all this has changed, and changed dramatically. Now we all realize that seeing the patient and his family as partners in the treatment has enormous benefits. Even the most liberal approach of autonomy also realizes that this has its limits. When it infringes on the rights of others, it's out of bounds. Not only damaging others or harming others is disallowed, even parking on the wrong side of the street, or in some places using the wrong language, can also get you into trouble. This logic applies to the Jewish approach. Freedom of choice is a basic tenet of our religion. Bechira chofshis. The pasuk says, Ra'ay noichi noichum v'shmeichum hayon brucho iklulu. Hashem says, I'm giving you brucho iklulu. And this is also based on the klal of Schar Va'Einish. In the day of reckoning, we will be rewarded for our good deeds and punished for what we should not have done. And so we are all obliged to act according to the laws of the Torah, and that includes the mitzvah of saving lives and preserving health. The sanctity of life is a primary and sacrosanct value. This value overrides many times the basic right and concept of personal autonomy. Now I want to add, before I begin the halachic explanation, I want to say a disclaimer. I will use sometimes the use of force, the word of force. I do not mean physical force. Just as we can't force anyone to keep Shabbos or to eat kosher, we can't impose upon anyone any treatment he refuses. All we are saying is that when the halachic stand is clear, we should say that very clearly to the patient that you have to do this and this, you have to take that treatment, you have to agree, and that's what the Torah wants you to do. But ultimately, the decision is his. It's a bechira chofshis, and we must act accordingly, especially when this is the law of the land. But I want to begin with the last shaila. A person who has gangrene, has the shulam developed in his foot, and the only way to save his life is to amputate, and he refuses. There's a medrash which has which relates to Parshas Shkolim. Today was Parshas Shkolim, Shabbat Shkolim, and the medrash says in Shkolim, Mishiyashu b'mikdash. There were a few stages to the collection of the Shkolim. It began with Chodesh Adar, and then 15 days in Adar, the Zavoyim went on all the cities to collect the Shkolim. And then 25 days in Adar, the collection agency sat down in Beis HaMikdash, and they started Lemashken as you saw the Al Shiklaim. They started seizing properties to collect these Shkolim. Moshal, what is the Moshal? Leifach also marked the ragler, someone who has a wound on his foot. The doctor bound him, he was cutting his flesh, the shvildera oisei, to heal him. Kachu marakodish borchi, maskeni yisroel al shiklaim, seize the properties of the yisroel to collect their shikolim, kedai shai karbonis siber krayv in my hand. We shall be able to bring the karbonis from their money. Al-Kapunim, this is the first reference in Chazal that a doctor who is clear that he has to heal someone, he can do it by force. And many folks can learn from here that not only when his life is in danger, whenever this is the healing, the treatment this person needs to heal his problem, the doctor can do it. Yes?
Is his pshat, or is it the only other pshat that the person has no anesthetic? So even if he agrees, you still have to bind him down, because otherwise he would move.
Correct. A good observation. But I don't think in the times of Chazal there was anesthesia.
No.
So you mean to say maybe he agrees?
Maybe he agrees.
No, but then the shikolim, what is the shikolim? The shikolim, we're talking about seizing property. Over there the person does not agree. So if Chazal used it as a muscle, it probably is the same issue. One of the first poskim who addressed this problem was the Moir Iktiyo, this is Rabbi Yankov Emden, who lived about 250 years ago. And he writes in Simen Shin Kuf Ches, Sidkut Nvuv, Koyitim lachoyla ha-mesarek b'mukam skuna. When there's a skuna, we can force him. B'chol inyan b'hoyitim shanatnu ha-toyer v'shus l'ray til ha-rapoysa. Kigoyim, lachtoy b'ud rachay shebamake, to cut flesh out of a wound, l'arach ha-piyum, to open it, to drain, l'arach ha-smosu, to drain a false wound, lach with shaver to set a cast. A Philip and a sea loves Ivan, even if an Ivan has to be amputated. Could I have seen him remove this? So we here see from here that the patient does not have a right to say, I don't want any treatment, I rely on Hashem, I have a minna, I have the tofu. No, we see from here that it's not the case. When the Torah says, you have to have your treatment, you have to go to a doctor, the doctor can do it against your will. But he adds a condition, a few conditions. Sometimes the patient does have a right to refuse. What is that? When we're talking about a choyli me'alam shebefinis haguf, when we're talking about an internal illness, where the doctor himself is in doubt, what is the nature of the illness and what is the treatment? But he wants to try, let's try this medication, let's try that medication, let's make exploratory surgery, the patient can refuse. And he can rely on Hashem to heal him. He can also add to Yaakov Emden that sometimes, when can we force the patient when his refusal is based on the mistake that he doesn't want to be Mechalel Shabbos. He feels that he wants to keep Shabbos, he doesn't want to have this treatment because it's Chilul Shabbos. But if he refuses to take medication because he doesn't believe that this medication is a proven medication for his situation, for his condition, even though it is only his impression, he doesn't have any proof for it, but since he feels that he's not sure that this is the right medication, and even more so when he has even one doctor that says the way he feels, even though the majority of doctors or the medical consensus is different, but if he has even one doctor that agrees with him, we cannot force him to do any medication. He has a right to refuse. So we see here that there's a condition. And if his refusal is based on logic, even if it's a logic which is not accepted, nevertheless, he has a right to that opinion, and we cannot force this treatment upon him. Now there's a story brought down in, there's a case in brought down in Sefer Shoshana Suamukim. The case was as follows. A person went in for a hernia surgery, hernia repair. And the doctor who checked him out, he did a digital exam and he found that he has a swollen prostate. And after a series of tests, the doctor came to the conclusion that we're dealing with prostate cancer. He explained it to the patient, and the patient said, no, I don't want, don't touch the prostate. Now the doctor is going to operate. It's in the same field of surgery. The doctor asks if he has to heed the refusal of the doctor, or he can just remove the prostate. This child was posed to Rav Eliyoshiv. Now, the answer was, we have to examine what is the reasons why this patient refuses. It can be one of three. Or the doctor, the patient feels, this is a hernia doctor, I'm not so sure he is an expert in prostatectomies. You repair the hernia, and then I'll seek out the best physician who can do the prostatectomy. That's one possible reason. Another reason can be, no, he doesn't want to do anything, he wants to rely on Hashem, it will disappear, and he doesn't want to do any treatment. The third possibility is, there are a few ways to do this surgery. There's radical prostatectomy, there's a more focused, sometimes it's enough when they implant a radioactive pellet. There are even more types of treatments. So he doesn't want to jump into it, he wants to take his time, do some research, and then we'll decide how to do it. So Rav Eliyoshiv's psak was that we have to examine his refusal. Why is he refusing? If it's based on logic, because he wants to seek a better doctor, or he wants to do research, or he wants to maybe not this treatment or another type of treatment, then definitely he has the right to do so. But if it's based on the mistake, on the assumption that the right thing to do is liftoya b'shem and not to do anything, this is against the Torah, and he has to be told very clearly that you have no right to refuse and the treatment has to go ahead. And he added Rav Eliyoshiv that in any case, if the treatment can wait, there's no point in doing it now against his will, and we can have we can give him some time to reconsider, and maybe we can convince him to go ahead and agree to the surgery. So we see here, first of all, that there are conditions when a patient's refusal can be honored, and when we have to reject it and go ahead with the treatment against his will. One of the biggest poskim in our time, Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Olav Shulam, also addressed this shaila dealing with an elderly patient. The question was, a person who is terminally ill and he is suffering from terrible pain. And the doctors want to go ahead with treatment and continue his life in pain. For instance, he mentions two possible treatments. One is amputation. He is in an immediate danger, and if his foot will be amputated, he will be able to live longer, but his life is in pain. The other shaila was a dialysis patient who has to be put on dialysis and he refuses. The question was if he has a right to refuse. Shlomo Zalman in two places, in two tshuvas, one in Chelik Beis Sumit Bayit Beis and one in Chelik Aleph Sumit Tzadik Aleph. I'm going to word it carefully because this is very, very a sensitive issue. He says that sometimes life, a person can say in life, it's worse than death. if he feels that he can't stand the pain. Or going on dialysis would be an enormous burden on his family and they won't be able to take it. And we find in Chazal that in some cases we can be mispavel on a chole, he should pass away earlier because he's in such suffering and such pain. Therefore, in such a situation, a person has a right to refuse treatment. But this has to be very carefully thought through and discussed with his rabbi and with his doctor. And if they all feel that this is the situation, we have to honor his refusal to the treatment. The second child was posed to him also similar, by a child who was very sick, and the surgery the doctor wanted to do would have left her a paraplegic or a quadriplegic. And the same answer was over there too, that they have a right to passively refuse the treatment because such a life can be considered as a life not worth living, and a person has a right to refuse. Now, I want to be careful here and say as follows. We're talking about patient autonomy. The patient has a right to refuse, but what is our advice to that patient is, that's not the right thing to do. The right thing to do is to live as long as HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives you life. More pain, less pain, that's not the issue. This is the right thing to do. A person can in 1 minute achieve something which he can never achieve by Olam Habu. So every minute of life is precious and should be prolonged. But we're talking about a case where the patient expressly refuses. In such a case, we cannot override his refusal and give him the treatment against his will, and he has a right to refuse. Of course, when a patient is incompetent, and the Beis Din have to decide what is the right thing to do for this patient. First of all, many times if he's incompetent, he's also not in pain. So then the normal rule applies, whereby life is precious and has to be prolonged as long as possible. I mentioned before that this is a sensitive issue. We hear a lot about quality of life. Quality is a relative term. By some, it means enjoying life. The truth is that enjoying life might be a good side benefit, but from a Jewish perspective, it's not the real reason we're all here. I have yet to meet a person who can tell me very clearly that his life, he's living in paradise. He has no worries, he has no problems. The truth is life is a struggle. Problems crop up all over in science, for some. His problems in the career, the family, finances, health, government, all types of problems. All of us have problems. The real quality is spiritual. And it's measured by what we have done to make the world and ourselves better. And for a Jew, it means living a life of Torah. Now the second issue. Can a parent refuse treatment for his child? Does the tshuva in Sefer Melamed Lehoyel, he was Rav David Friedman in Germany about 150 years ago, he was asked if a doctor can operate on a child when the parents refuse this surgery. His answer is very terse and short, and he says, "Lo mitzino b'chol ha'tayre kila." We don't find in the whole Torah, "Sheyesh la'ave em reshut," the parents have the permission, to endanger the lives of their children, and to prevent the doctor to heal them. This is the law of the Torah. Din of the Mechusa and any of there. That's why he wrote that. I don't know what the Din of Mechusa is, but this is the Din Torah. If this is the right treatment for the child, to save the child, then they have absolutely no stand here to refuse this treatment. Now what is the case when it's opposite, the other way around. The parents want to submit their children to a certain treatment, and we're not sure that this is really beneficial to their health. For instance, cosmetic surgery. There's a shayla in Sefer Shoshana Tzomukin. When a child was born, he's 5.5 months old. He was born with a hemangioma. It's a big birth, how do you call it, birthmark. A very ugly birthmark on his whole, on his whole abdomen and on the feet. This is not dangerous. But it's very, can I use the term ugly? It's repulsive. And the shayla is the children, if the parents have the right to submit their child to extensive surgery to have that removed. Now it's removed without surgery, with laser treatment, but you need general anesthesia, and you need, it's a series of treatments, and it can be painful too. So the question was if parents can have their children, to submit their children to it. Rabbi Yosef paskened that definitely yes. Since this is beneficial to the child will grow up and he'll suffer from it, he'll suffer from socially from this problem, so therefore it's considered as a benefit to the child, and the parents have a right to agree to it. There was another shayla, a child who had crowded teeth, and he had to undergo cosmetic orthodontic treatment. He had to remove a few healthy teeth and to straighten out the teeth in his mouth. The child wasn't that small already, he was probably about 10, 11 years old, and he very much was against it. Here we have to force the child to have this treatment because the parents feel that it's not nice. It's not acceptable. The second shayla he was posed there was, and this is really a difficult shayla, one of the children in the family developed renal failure. And the only way to save them is by a donor, a kidney donor. And the most suitable one to donate the kidney was a younger child, younger brother or sister, a minor. The question was if parents can try to have a healthy kidney removed from a young child to have it to save the life of a brother or a sister. I don't know what the legal, what is legally the case here. In any case, the fact was that in the first case, when we're talking about cosmetic surgery, if it's clear that this malformation of the teeth is pronounced and he's going to have a problem with it later on, and we can assume that the child himself, only because he's not old enough, so he doesn't understand the problems that can develop with such amount of teeth, and if we feel that this is the right way to do it, the right thing to do, he can be forced to do it. And on the other hand, when it comes to donating a kidney, or even in that case, donating bone marrow, we cannot, the parents do not have a right, according to the Torah, to submit their child to the surgery, because this is not to the benefit of the child. They were granted guardianship to do anything possible for which is benefit for the child, apotropos. So that they do not have the right, even if it comes to saving another life, to take away a healthy kidney from a child. Yes?
Does the child then have the right to agree to it, or because he's a minor?
Also, he's a minor.
So the kidney would not be able to
No.
At what age, according to the
law? 13 years old by a boy and 12 years old by a girl. Another child was a child who is probably suffering from celiac disease, and to determine that diagnosis, the child has to undergo biopsies, painful tests, and the child refuses. And also the fact there was that since this is beneficial for the health of the child, the parents have a right to sign and submit the child to these tests and medications. The Moshe Feinstein of the Shulam summarizes this issue as follows. It's permissible to force a patient to take medication if there's no good reason for his refusal, and on the condition that the patient will not become frightened by being forced. Sometimes when medication is given by force, it can be harmful. So in such a case, the patient should never be forced to take medication. If the patient refuses for reasons which appear to be childish, like he doesn't like the taste, or he doesn't want to be disturbed, or in such a case, he can be compelled to take the medication. But if the patient refuses to take the medication because he does not trust this particular doctor, then if possible, we should try to find another doctor which the patient does trust. If no such doctor can be found, or there's no time to find another doctor because of the urgency of the situation, then the doctor, in consultation with other doctors in the hospital, should try to compel the patient to take the medicine. However, if there's a risk that the patient might become terrified or shocked if he or she is compelled to take the medication, then he should not be forced to take it, even if the refusal is for childish reasons. If the medication itself is risky, and normally the doctors balance the risk of it causing harm against the seriousness of the illness, and the patient refuses to take it, he cannot be compelled to take that medication. Because then, as I mentioned before from Rubianka Venden, that is justified that he might refuse, he can refuse that treatment. Let's go over to the issue of immunization. And this touches on the Chiyav Leroy Falarapois. Here we're talking about maintaining health, living a healthy lifestyle, doing everything to prevent, to prophylactically, to prevent becoming sick. There's a chiyuv in the Torah, a very basic chiyuv, who said, "V'nishmartem ma'od l'nafshecheichem." This obliges us to keep our health, to watch our health, and not to become sick. And this includes taking necessary vaccinations. There's a Mishnah in Maseches Yoma which says, "Mi shenosh ha'kelef shoyta, ayin machinen oisay mechatan ha'kubet shaloi." I think this is the first mention of vaccination in Chazal. We talk about a kelef shoyta which is rabies, and he was bitten. So the treatment was, way back, they used to give the patient to eat from the chutra ha'kubet, from the diaphragm, from this dog. They took a part of the dog's body and they gave him to eat this piece, and seemingly this caused some sort of an antibody production which helped him overcome this disease. And then what is the treatment now? I think something similar. They give antibodies against rabies when a person is exposed to the disease. The reason why the machlok is over there is because the poskim say it's a refuah she'ein beduka. It's an unproven medicine. But now the vaccination has been proven, as we heard before, to eradicate most of the serious diseases. So no question about it, vaccination is included in the mitzvah of v'nishmartem ma'od l'nafshecheichem. The Tiferes Yisrael said something interesting over there in Sefer Yoma. He's talking about vaccination against, I think it's smallpox, ababuot, smallpox. He says that although there's a slight risk taking this medication, seems that in his time the virus wasn't exactly completely killed, and it could have caused a contraction of the disease. Nevertheless, a person is obliged to undergo a small risk to save himself a major risk later on. So here we're talking about vaccination which might have some sort of allergic reaction or another type of risk. Nevertheless, since the benefit of this vaccination is much greater than the risk, this justifies taking this treatment. So when we talk about parents agreeing or disagreeing to vaccinating their children, yes? Yeah, so let's get back to the question here. If parents, because of religious reasons, have a right to disagree to have their children vaccinated, we have to basically examine what the reasons are for this refusal. If it's based on reasons of religion, at least in our religion, in Jewish religion, this is baseless. They have to take this medication, this vaccination. And we have to say very clearly to them, and if they refuse, they have no right to refuse. And the children have to be vaccinated. For instance, if the school system vaccinates all the children, even if the parents do not agree, this vaccination should go ahead. But if they disagree because of medical reasons, for instance, they read in a paper that something like this happened, or they heard from a neighbor or from a doctor that says that the chances now to contract this disease are so small that it's not really necessary to take this vaccination. Even though from a public's perspective, this is wrong, because if everyone would say so, then there's going to be a resurgence of this disease. But if one person says so, publicly speaking, I don't think there's a real risk, because if the whole school system is vaccinated, even one child is not vaccinated, it does not pose a risk to the other children, because they're all vaccinated. So if there's some logic in their refusal, like it's based on not really trusting the reason why this vaccination should be given, then we should honor their refusal. Yes?
Yeah, the question about the Mishnah you stated, I just want to know how we, because it sounds like it's not so much preventive care in this case. I mean, it's not a primary prevention. It sounds like this is somebody who's exposed to that we're treating.
Now, I don't think, I only mentioned it saying that the first mention of vaccination or treatment by...
It's not exactly the same thing. It's not about, I mean, we're giving treatment for somebody who's exposed. He doesn't have rabies, but there's a potential he could get it. So we're actually preventing rabies in this person with a treatment.
Yes.
It's not like universally vaccinating everybody.
Absolutely.
Against
something. I agree. But I just said that the concept of using the person's own immune system to treat the sickness was already found in Chazal. This is similar because we're stimulating the immune system to generate antibodies, and this will help prevent the development of the disease. Okay, now let's go over to the question of the pregnant woman with Down syndrome. Dr. Oppenheim said before that this is a rare situation because doctors now prefer vaginal birth. But what happens when the child is in a breech presentation? Or how do you call it when it's a bariach? When it's in the transverse presentation. And in such a case, a C-section is necessary to save the child. And she refuses. Well, what happens when the father refuses and the mother agrees? What happens when the child is in fetal distress? And we have to save the life of the child, and the mother refuses. So what do we do? There's a shayla in the same sefer, Shoshana Suamukim, a woman in the week 42, she was diagnosed with preeclampsia, and the child had severe fetal distress, and she, for any reason, refused to sign the consent form. She didn't want to undergo the C-section. She is competent, yes. And she refuses. And maybe for any, I don't know why, but she refuses. There's a psak of Rishon Lezion, the psak of Shmir Shabbos Kilchusay. Although this is a sefer of Hilchos Shabbos, he brings down there a psak of Rishon Lezion, saying that a person cannot be compelled to undergo a risk, even a small risk, in order to save the life of someone else. So since a C-section involves some sort of a risk, even if it's a minor risk, we cannot compel her to undergo that risk to save the life of her child. Rabbi Yoshev added to that psak, and he said as follows. We can be quite sure that if would the mother, the woman giving birth, understand the ramifications of her decision, that she might lose the child, she would have agreed. The reason she's not agreeing is because she's misinformed. She doesn't have the right information. Maybe she's afraid, maybe she doesn't trust the doctor. So we have to do everything in our power to convince her and to explain to her how important and necessary it is to do this procedure to save the life of her child. So if we can assume that her refusal is based on misinformation, then we can go ahead with the procedure. But if we know for sure that she knows all the facts, and nevertheless she refuses, only in such a case we cannot override her refusal. What happens when the child is really deformed or has a severe malformation like Down syndrome? In such a case, the person has a right to refuse because the life of the child is compromised. He might be retarded, as in Down syndrome. He might have other severe problems, health problems. In such a case, the mother has a right to refuse active treatment such as a C-section to save the life of the child. But the minute the child is born, it's because nefesh, and everything has to be done to save the life of the child, no matter if the child is deformed or has Down syndrome, anything and everything has to be done, and then we don't even have to ask the mother's permission or the parent's permission to do that. Another case which is discussed there is when there's such a presentation where, like a transverse presentation, where the surgery might compromise the fertility potential of the mother. There's a way to explain there, maybe the doctors can disagree. It's explained there that when in such a presentation, the uterus has to be opened all across, and that sometimes can preclude further pregnancies, because the uterus might tear during pregnancy. So the question was, if the mother can refuse this cesarean because of the concern that she might not be able to have additional children. Over here, the psak was very clear that she has a right to refuse. Because the person is not required to give up a part of his body to save the life of someone else. If a person wants to donate a kidney, that's something else. But we can't force upon anyone to donate part of his body to save someone else's life, even if it's a very minor risk. The same would apply for a bone marrow donation. Although the risk is very small, it's similar to a blood donation. Nevertheless, there is a risk, and we can't force anyone to do it, although it's very, very much recommended. Yes?
For the cesarean section with a transverse presentation or something like that, If you don't do a C-section, then what's going to happen? I think that the only alternative would be to destroy the baby and take it out, because it can't be born like that, no?
So what happens if the mother goes into labor in such a case?
Typically, these mothers will always, you'll always do a classical cesarean, which means you open it from up and down with the uterus. I can't really imagine a mother saying no to that, because it won't really affect their fertility. It comes into question how they're going to be delivered for the subsequent baby. So the subsequent baby will automatically be another cesarean.
But you will be able to save the child with a classical cesarean?
Yeah, for sure, of course.
So what is it that you have to open with?
If there's, for example, sometimes when it's very premature and the baby's in a malpresentation, like you mentioned, the transverse, those, you can't do the normal cesarean, which is transverse, because the uterus is too small. So your incision won't be big enough to be able to take out the baby. So you have to open the uterus, pretty much cut it in two, from top to bottom, and then you have enough room to take out the baby.
In such a case, if further pregnancies are in danger?
Not fertility, because first of all, if this lady got pregnant, she's got a good chance of getting pregnant in the future. The only thing that it'll do for her is in the next time, when it's time to deliver, you're not going to let her labor. Because if she labors, then her uterus can rupture on that scar.
She's not right.
So she's an automatic cesarean.
Yeah, but there's no danger to pregnancies in general.
Well, that kind of cesarean, there's a lot of morbidity because it's bleeds a lot, and they'll for sure lose a lot of blood at it. So it's not something that we'd like to do. So that I can see the argument of the mother saying, maybe back 20 years ago, where they for sure required transfusions, and there's stuff that we could do now with different medications to lower the amount of blood. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly more morbidity with that operation.
But what is the consequence of not doing this section if the baby can't be born another way?
Well, you can do an internal podalic version. You can rotate the baby. So you can try externally first. You can try to turn the baby.
But that you can do even if you're doing the section.
So, yes, so that's the first thing you can do. If it doesn't work, I mean, this is, let's say, a 22-weeker. And you're not going to try to save the baby at 22 weeks because you know it's not going to survive. If the baby dies inside, then you know you can dilate the cervix and do an extraction. There's different ways you can turn it. You grab the seed.
Well, we're talking about a term baby. It's a baby that's a term. And so what do we do then? If she goes into labor and it's a transverse presentation.
Well, that just...
And she refuses the C-section.
I mean...
Is it dangerous to the life of the mother too?
Well, sure. If this baby is, let's say, back is down,
mm-hmm.
and she starts to dilate, this baby is not going to come in. If the back is up, you know, it's easier. You can let her dilate, and then you go and you grab the seed and you deliver it. But if she refuses, her uterus will rupture.
Uh-huh. And her life is also dangerous.
Yeah,
so then we can't ask her anything. We have to do what we have to do. In such a case, if you don't have consent, you would go ahead with it?
I get a psychiatrist. I don't know. I should have a psychiatrist because it's really not to my knowledge, I can't just go and take someone to the operating room without a consent, and I would never do that.
But in an emergency, I think the law does allow you to do
it. If she ruptures her uterus and she goes unconscious, I think that's an easier decision.
Mm-hmm.
But if she's awake and she says no,
we can get a court order.
Oh, yeah. But so it's sometimes where a patient refuses life, obviously it's had some life-saving therapy would allow the person to die rather than impose it on them. That
you're asking me, or
and that seems to be what you're saying.
I don't know. I mean, it seems very counterintuitive to me.
So what? So you're
it's very different surgically. You know, operating on someone, you're actually, you know, you have to put them to sleep, and you're. Not like giving, you know, some medication. Maybe it's me, and I don't know about other surgeons, but I'm not going to operate on someone without their consent. It's an operation, and I don't think you're alive, so I don't know.
Okay, so that's a very moral question, and I'm interested to hear what the law says about it.
I think you can't do it.
You're not.
You can't do it.
I think if the person is, you can show that this person is competent.
You ask someone to evaluate them.
You may have to get their competence with, but if the person is presumed to be competent until proven otherwise, and if you cannot show incompetence, they're not delusional, then...
So let them die.
Hematology is a person has leukemia and they're a Jehovah's Witness and it's impossible to treat leukemia without transfusions and they refuse. We don't treat them and they die.
Absolutely.
I've seen that more than once.
I've seen
what about you were going to say about the bone marrow?
I had a question though about the indicated cesarean for the baby and the woman refusing. Let's say that you have parents who anticipate, like others in their community, having 8 or 10 or 12 or 15 children. And this is for the first or second or third child, and she knows that if she has a cesarean, she would never be able to have that number of children.
We do see that number of children with cesareans, but you'll have to have every birth to go to cesarean.
I'll give you an example. It's one person that I've seen her uterus rupture, and this is a patient that had one or two, and then she had a cesarean for a good indication, and she had like one or two VBAC, vaginal births after cesarean, and then she ruptured. You counsel them, you tell them. And eventually, you know, if you rupture a uterus, you're the last person you're going to try to have another vaginal birth on. These are just as bad as a classical cesarean. You give your advice, you give your suggestions, you tell them how...
Yes, but what I'm saying is that if they
just operate on a person, you know...
But what I'm saying is, after someone has a cesarean, you don't tell them you should only have X more pregnancies?
No, no. You can have the pregnancy, but each pregnancy has to have a cesarean.
With counseling on repeated pregnancy, you can counsel all you want that the person walks into your office pregnant. But what's the current advice? The current advice?
I had a cesarean. How many more can I have?
Well, one cesarean, for sure you can have another one, two cesareans. Three, it really depends on when you do your repeat cesarean. Mm-hmm. If you walk in and you see everything stuck like glue, the bladder stuck to the uterus, the bowel stuck to the bladder, and you injure it, let's say, the bladder when you go in, these are some people that you're going to tell them don't have another baby. The other hand, I'll tell you that I've done third, fourth cesareans that it was like doing a first cesarean.
Can you do 10?
I haven't seen that, but I'll tell you.
I have heard of those.
If you have to three and four, it gets very sticky and messy, and so you can injure organs. But I have seen a fourth cesarean, which it was like doing a first-time cesarean.
Okay, that's it. Now, there's going to be one additional shiur before Pesach, and then after Pesach we'll have to go over to Sunday, and we'll make a short survey to find out when on Sunday is better, Sunday afternoon or Sunday evening. Agutava.
No problem with you doing this. But as far as
by his voice, he's
working on the phone.
They're very popular.
Thank you. There's actually a whole piece about it. It's a book called Kaya Kakadeva.
Okay.
Unfortunately, you're not
My wife all the time was very, very weird doctor. I was working as you can hear, now I'm working in research, now as a doctor, because I have lived the life process anyway. Hashem, I have
okay, now let me tell you what we plan to do. We plan to have a pool of women, let's say three or four women. There's going to be one dispatcher, especially the person who takes the call from the patient, and this dispatcher will call 1, 2, 3, 4, which one is available to go in the lab at this moment. You drive a car? Okay. So it can be any time, but they will not know a day in advance.
question for Imam Sheikh is, we don't have family at all. We are alone here. So how we organize with we have children and little babies at home.
So what do you think?
I was one day in the week, for example. My day is Monday. I can organize for Monday, but not Monday.
I'm going to put together 3, 4, or maybe 5 minutes. So you can cover Monday. Maybe someone else can cover Tuesday. But the way it works here in all over is that one supervisor takes over a cycle.
This is the problem. You don't know when
in fact, no, the cycle can take three visits.
I know, but...
By collection, and then by personalization, and then by transfer.
Yes, but the first day is the most long day, because in this day you have to present the tenant, to take the oversight, and which is the next day, you have to do it in the afternoon. So you don't know if this is Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, when is the complete day, and you have to take the tenant.
Okay, we'll see. So you say you can only be available one day.
But it's not that I need to know which day.
So now you have, maybe you have more people that you know that can be suitable for this. Where do you live? In
the
bus? I need someone who lives not far from the
Yuma.
Downtown. Of course, So I need someone from there who lives in the vicinity. Maybe you know someone there. Look around.
Yeah.
Okay, you also look around. If you have more people who might be interested in this, we'll put together just a team of people. We'll work as a team.
Yeah.
One of you must be available at all times. But if we have 5, then I assume there's always someone who's going to be available.
In Argentina, we were overwhelmed. Because we were the only one, and it was very, very hard.
There's so many.
Yes, and we had another rabbi who gave us tradition with Azoka.
Who was that, Feristo?
Feristo, but most of the kids are not with Rabbi Feristo, with Rabbi Meta. He's with the Azoka of Rabbi Botman. So, and he is dedicated his Rabbi Meta full-time.
He has a woman staff for all the day, every day.
Every week they have a case.
What we're going to have here, we're going to have integrated with a lock. And only the Moshiach will have the lock. So they won't be able to access these temples without the Moshiach.
It's not necessary to put any sticker in
it. No. Stickers is problematic. It's problematic. And the government won't like it. But I told them we're going to buy an incubator and also a tank, freezing tank.
One enough. So we don't need to put any special simonim for the freezing.
No. We're going to have a separate tank. What?
You ask to take the protein from the woman to use in the treatment?
No.
Okay.
I know that's not
required. Yeah,
for us it was an extra day.
I do not think that this has an effect on the fetus.
So the doctor can use all the liquid.
All the liquid, we don't have to check the liquid. Any kind of.
We only have to check the sample.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's called HSA. Yeah, right? HSA. Yeah. Human serum albumin.
Yes.
Yeah. It's sometimes synthetic. I heard that there is
some
synthetic.
Yes. No, they told me it's very expensive.
Yeah, that's why.
Yeah,
that's what happened.
Yeah.
What is your profession in medicine?
I'm an obstetrician.
You're obstetrician. And you didn't take the exam here?
No, but I didn't work in Argentina.
No?
All the kids run next to me.
How many children do you have?
6 kids. I'm not alone. I think I was working all the day.
So you're here with a permit, an immigration?
Yes, permanent
resident. Fine, okay.
So it's for you.
We'll be in touch. Yeah. You only have one telephone number?
At home?
I called you a lot at home and no one answered.
Maybe but we are with the children. But if not, yes, we're at home, I'm at work.
Okay.
I am in the show.
You have my message, right?
Yes.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll get to
I got a phone call just from something. They wanted to make whatever. The people calling them after 1 hour.
His problem is the same name, a different name, that's his business. I don't know, that's about the business. But there's a bigger problem here, MK alone, to make MK better, or to make, well, what's Badat going to be? There's going to be MK or something with a Badat, well, what's it going to be? I don't care what his problem is, but our problem is you have to make it, and the question is just on what do you do it? On what are you going to put it?
Is there a big problem?
On what are you going to put it?
Yeah. Is this a man?
Look. Yeah, I know, but then we still put it on the same as the wrong way.
I want to understand this better. No, I'm not talking about me now, I'm talking about what he's going to tell him. He told me this is the most, we did what we can, and that was.
It doesn't work if I have a job.
I know the issue. The issue is a very, very high issue.
So what did you read about Yeshiva's Halva Torah?
Whatever I said to you last week.
They supposedly claimed that there were you guys.
Why the guy told them that they were cooking?
Yeah.
Yeshiva with me.
He learned from why you went to Yeshiva.
No, no, no. There's as well for us. I had a good thing. 5 minutes.
It's a mess that you didn't become an upper cook.
Well, you know, look at that. You came up from Moshe. It's a testing. I don't know what happened to
you. You learned very much Shavira?
Yeah.
No, Berman, the whole bunch of them, the Avi Weiss, they took out the modern orthodoxy of Sifrim Yulam. So why you a Sifrim? This is basically my line.
Okay,
why are you
coming back? 70 faces from Norman Lab. No.
What do you see?
All four done.
You got all this from tonight. Tonight's listening.
Guess what? He's going to tell you the same thing. I'll just watch while he listens to him and he listens to you.
No, we always get better. We have an issue that we always wish it is.
What is the problem?
Okay. So we have to get established.
paper cups, you know, I see all kinds of papers.
What's happening here?